We have a very interesting subject for discussion today, the psychology of true happiness. Now, if you look at the history of human civilization, you will find every human effort, attempt to develop new tools of science and technology, new paradigms of life, as being an attempt to experience happiness. And we all experience happiness, that's true. We are not always unhappy. But this happiness is not permanent. So that's a real problem. Everyone goes through this experience of happiness, satisfaction, or contentment. At some point of life, we strive for it. In fact, we make use of the tools of science and technology, and even the tools of religion, philosophy, and mysticism to experience happiness. As I mentioned, but this happiness is not a continuous, unbroken flow of happiness. There is no permanence in this happiness, experience of happiness. So when we actually talk about unhappiness, we are only talking about the impermanence of the happiness that we experience. So that's a reality. As I mentioned, nobody is perpetually unhappy all the time. Then you cannot live in this world. So the problem is we are not always happy. There's always a gap, a transition from a state of unhappiness to happiness. There is always no succession, there is no continuity. Now, what's the reason for this lack of continuity? Well, I'm not trying to explain this in the light of what we call today positive psychology or the new paradigms in psychological research. What I'm trying to do is to present before you an underlying philosophy of life which Vedanta expounded thousands of years back. In this modern 21st century, when you talk about an ancient philosophy, there is always some difficulty in understanding or appreciating. Well, Vedanta tells you that there is no continuity in this experience of happiness because we are looking for happiness outside of ourselves. Not within, but outside. So there is happiness that science and technology and physical comforts can give you, but this happiness comes from outside. Without a philosophy of life which tells you that your true nature is a state of perpetual happiness, that happiness is our inherent natural nature, natural tendency, natural character. And whatever happiness we experience outside is only a reflection of this. So happiness is not something that you look for outside of ourselves. It is something that we experience within. The best way I can present this philosophy of happiness It is both the psychology of happiness and also philosophy of happiness. In the light of Vedanta is to present before you a dialogue between a great philosopher of ancient times and his wife. So it is a very natural situation. It is not a dialogue that takes place in the forests or a hermitage or on a platform. It's a dialogue that takes place in a family setting, maybe in the kitchen of an ancient home, between a husband and his wife. The husband was a great philosopher. His name was Yajnavalkya. He was a saint and philosopher, and he had a very interesting dialogue with his wife. So the story is something like this. You know, in ancient times, in the Vedic period, they had these four stages of life which every householder should go through. So when you are young, you study, and then you marry, then you become settled in your family life, performing the duties and responsibilities and obligations of husband and wife, brother and sister, and uncle and aunt, different positions in the family setting. And then when you get old, not too old, then also you don't become desperate. There is no retirement in old age home. Rather, old age is an opportunity to get an elevation, an ascent in your life status. You become a philosopher when you become old. So at that point, husbands and wife, householders, used to retire from their household, from their homes, go to a lonely place and spend the rest of their lifetime in meditation and in contemplation, and much more important, in imparting Vedic wisdom to children, to students who came from all over India. So in some of the Upanishads, the Brihadaranyaka and Chandogya Upanishads, which are very ancient documents of human civilization, not only spirituality, they give you a picture of the sociology of ancient times. A very interesting philosophy of life, which is very relevant in this 21st century. So there is no need for anyone to be continuously working all the time to remain relevant in your family or in society. The problem is, we are afraid that when we cannot work anymore, when we fall sick, then we become irrelevant. We become insignificant. Young people will start looking upon you as a burden, as an obstacle, as irrelevant human beings. This is one of the tragedies of modern family structure. But in ancient Vedic civilization, this is very interesting, they used to retire to a forest hermitage, or maybe in their own homes, they may spend the rest of their lifetime in a state of absolute blessedness. They experience the wisdom and the knowledge they have acquired through their life. You know, there is a kind of wisdom that you acquire only when you get old. That is not very often appreciated in modern times. There is some kind of wisdom and maturity that you can experience only when you become physically and mentally old. Now, so they used to go retire to a lonely place where they spend the rest of the lifetime in contemplation and meditation. And you will be surprised, many of these documents which I am going to quote right now, all the ancient Vedantic texts, at least 75% of them, which Vivekananda and modern Indian philosophers and Western thinkers like Paul Deuce and Max Muller and others expounded in modern times. Many of these great teachings were imparted by retired householders who have had active life as householders and then retired to forest hermitages and imparted this wisdom. I can quote you one verse from Manusmriti. Manu says something very interesting. Grihasthasvyada pasyed vali palidam atmanaha apatyasi apatyam tada aranyam samasriye. This is this statement. It is a statement that gives you a picture of the sociology and the psychology and philosophy of the life of an ideal householder, maybe the third millennium BC during the early Vedic period. An householder, a mother and father, or grandmother, grandfather mostly, when they find that their face is getting wrinkled and their hair is getting gray, then they should not remain in their home controlling their great-great children, grandchildren. What they should do? They should retire to a lonely place. And they should spend the rest of their lifetime in solitude, contemplation, and again, much more important, in imparting this ancient wisdom. So Yajnavalkya was such a person who was getting ready to go to a forest hermitage and eventually to become a mendicant. In very many cases in ancient times, the wives also sometimes, very often, took the mendicancy, but not always. So there's an interesting dialogue. Yajnavalkya is talking to his wife Maitreyi. You know, he had two wives. So he decided to divide his property equally among his two wives, leaving nothing for him, and go to a forest hermitage and spend the rest of the lifetime in meditation and teaching. In very many cases, as I mentioned, in ancient times, the wives also followed the footsteps of the husband, but not there was no compulsion, it was not mandatory. So Yajnavalkya called Maitreyi, his wife. Now look here, I'm planning to retire. So I'm dividing my property equally amongst you. So all this wealth, everything is yours from tomorrow onwards. So Yajnavalkya made this statement. Then the wife, who was as wise, as saintly as the husband, puts a counter question. That's the beginning of this dialogue. She asks, Sahovacha Maitri, Yennu Maiyam Bhago Sarva Prithivi Vittera Purnasya Katham Tena Amurdasyamiti. So, I'm quoting this verse because it is very important. It's not something that we just expound in modern language, diluting things to make it adjustable or digestible to modern taste. I don't want to do that, so I want to recite the real ancient verse, which may have been recorded around 5,000 years back. So she's asking this question, is this wealth going to make me happy? Is this going to make me perpetually happy? Is it going to make me satisfied, contented, and happiness for all times? This is the question she puts. She needs a lot of wisdom to ask this question, a lot of spiritual and philosophical wisdom. In the Mahabharata, there is a mother the mother says, you know, pursuit of happiness at the worldly level, at the sensory level, is like trying to put out fire by pouring more butter and ghee and maybe oil in modern times. So you try to put out the fire of desire, the fire of thirst for worldly sensual enjoyments. How do you put out the fire? By pouring ghee, giving clarified butter or oil into it. You have to, maybe you have to use some fire extinguisher. So if you try to find out the extent to which you can go, if you want to enjoy maximum pleasure and then expecting, then you expect to reach a point where you don't have any more desire. It's like trying to put out fire by pouring oil or butter or ghee, which is called clarified butter, into it. It's not going to happen. So Maitreyi was a wise person. So she knew this. So Yajnavalkya told him, no. Neti hovaja Yajnavalkya ithaiva upakaranapadam jividam tasseiva te jividam syat amrutatvasya tu na aashasti vittena iti. I shall just quote very fast because we are not discussing the mantra, but it's interesting to recite this mantra, to quote this mantra whenever it is necessary. Yajnavalkya says, no, this money, this wealth which I am going to give you, your share of the property, not his, her share, the whole property was divided between two of them. This wealth is not going to make you happy. So in order to recognize that happiness that comes from outside, happiness produced by worldly achievements, worldly enjoyments, will be short-lived, will not be lasting, to recognize this truth, you should be a wise person. And that wisdom can come through contemplation, meditation, or spiritual progress. So Yajnavalkya told her, you are right. She knew this wealth is okay, but is this wealth going to make me happy all the time? So Yajnavalkya correctly understood her mind and said, this wealth is not going to make you happy. And now this lady, she doesn't stop the dialogue. She asked the question, what is that which is going to make me happy so that I will stop looking for happiness any further? As I mentioned at the beginning of this lecture, we all experience happiness. But that happiness, which is produced by acquiring something from outside of ourselves, a happiness that comes from outside, wealth, status, enjoyments, all these are necessary. No doubt about it. All these are necessary for people. But it is also equally important to understand that these things are not going to make us happy for all time. Out of that recognition, you get real happiness. So, the beginning of the search for permanent happiness begins when you realize that the happiness that comes from outside is not going to last long. That's the beginning of real happiness. So it should be understood very clearly. Vedanta is not a life-negating, a world-negating, extreme asceticism. Vedanta is as idealistic as it is realistic. It is both realistic and idealistic. Vedanta tells you, it presents before you a philosophy of total happiness. That means a happiness that is not that is not short-lived, a happiness that makes you feel that there is no more need for you to look for happiness. That is the contribution of Vedanta philosophy. So that's why one of our most important scriptures defines this happiness as something that is beyond sensory perception, where the senses do not succeed even in recognizing an enjoyment or a happiness that goes beyond the happiness experienced by the senses and mind. That happiness is the ultimate happiness. So, sukham atyandikam yettat buddhir grahim atindriyam, that is the Gita says. Sukha means happiness. But that happiness, it is absolute, ultimate, permanent, everlasting happiness. Again, a happiness that gives you the wisdom to understand the limitation of worldly happiness. Rather, that happiness which can help you to stop looking for happiness any further. See, real happiness comes only when you stop looking for happiness. Because you will be looking for something that you don't already have. When you have it, and when you realize it, that our true nature is happiness in its most ultimate and in most absolute dimension, then we won't be looking for happiness at the worldly level. See, somebody who has got $1 billion in the bank, he won't struggle or go out of his way to pick up nickels from the streets. He knows he has something much more precious that is his. That's what exactly Maitreya is leading this dialogue. So Maitreya asked this question: is this wealth going to make me happy for all time? She uses the word amrita. Amrita actually means immortality, means it is deathlessness, means a state of deathless or ultimate, absolute, everlasting happiness. Is this money, this wealth, going to make me happy like that? Yajnavalkya said, no, it's not going to make you happy like that. Then Maitreya puts forward this request: please teach me that science which will make me happy in such a way, as I mentioned, that I will stop looking for happiness any further. Sahovacha Maitreyi Yenakam na Amrutasyam Kimakam Tena Guryam. If this wealth is not going to make me perpetually happy, then what am I going to do with it? Then Yajnavalkya unfolds the greatest philosophy of Vedanta in his reply. Then he says, we all try to make others happy. And actually, our every effort, every attempt to make others happy is actually an attempt to make ourselves happy. So he gives the example. A wife loves the husband, a husband loves the wife, a mother loves the child, and the child loves the mother. So the question arises, why does a mother love the child? Well, from a very superficial point of view, we can say that will make the child happy. It's a normal interpretation. But Yajnavalkya says, no, it's not. That's only part of the picture, a fragment of the reality. You know why a mother loves the child? Because by loving the child, the mother herself derives a great happiness. If loving her child makes a mother miserable, she will not love her child. So loving a child or taking care of the child or doing anything that apparently makes others happy is ultimately an attempt to make ourselves happy. Because the real happiness is coming from within ourselves. not from outside. So every effort and attempt to derive happiness outside of ourselves ultimately may produce happiness, but that happiness is only coming from within ourselves. Once we understand this, then we will have no problem. In fact, we will stop looking for happiness. Not because it is not available, not because it cannot be found, but because there is no need at all to look for happiness outside of ourselves. Because our true nature is happiness itself. So Vedanta tells you, we are a structure put inside a five-fold sheath, or five sheaths, so to speak. These five sheaths, in a way, represent five levels of consciousness and five dimensions of happiness, five interpretations of happiness. At the most physical level, it's called, you know, Annamaya, Pranamaya, Manomaya, Vijnanamaya, Anandamaya. This is a Pancha Kosha Vivarana. In the Ayurveda you find, in many other Vedic traditions you find, in the Taittiriya Upanishad you find. I'm not going to the scriptural, the theological background of this analysis. So it's a very simple. The point is, very often, you know, if you don't quote the original scripture, then one may think we are trying to concord this new ultra-modern positive psychology and things like that. So you may consider this as a very superficial, diluted, in make-believe, playing to the gallery. That's what happens when you don't quote the scripture. It is something, it's just like mindfulness is a 21st century invention, the way people are trying to put it, forgetting the fact that mindfulness is the subject of discussion in one of Buddha's dialogues, Satipatthana Sutta, which belonged to 6th century BC. So it's a different matter. So if you quote the scripture, then you may think it's an ancient idea. But if you leave that behind, then you may think it's an ultra-modern, diluted, modern version of an ancient wisdom. So I want to strike a balance between these two extreme possible interpretations. So I shall leave the theological, scriptural background behind. So it is called five sheets. Now, we have these five dimensions to our personality. At the most physical, superficial, at the grossest level, we are the physical body. And we look for happiness at the physical level. But then this happiness is superficial. You know, what makes you physically happy now could be a prelude to tragedy, disaster, unhappiness that may unfold in course of time. So it is happiness, but only relative, not permanent. But then there is a higher kind of happiness. It may be happiness at the level of vital energies. Happiness we feel for some time, and that happiness becomes unhappiness the next moment. And again, at the mental level, manomaya kosha, mind can be happy, even the body doesn't, body is not even in a very happy condition. Those who are far higher in their evolution, those who are much more highly evolved, can be in a state of absolute calmness, happiness, and tranquility, even when their body is sick. How do you explain Stephen Hawking surviving so many years? He was busy with modern physics or mathematics. He was living at a different level. Not spiritual level, but he was living at the, let us say, the pranamaya kosha, manomaya kosha, or vijnanamaya kosha, at the mental or intellectual level. So one can be happy mentally, intellectually, even when the body is full of pain. When the body gives you pain, you can remain mentally happy, intellectually happy and satisfied. When we transcend the bodily level, when we think this body is something that we have, you know, I am a mind, or I am the prana or vital force, I have a body. The body is secondary. So a person who has evolved to that level of psychological or intellectual dimension of the personality can remain perfectly happy and contented even when you are physically sick, because you identify yourself with something which is not affected by an illness or a disease, the way body is affected. So you are able to dissociate yourself from the body that is sick, from the body that gives you pain. I give the example of great scientists, maybe the latest example who passed away, Stephen Hawking. If you were not a scientist, if you were not a physicist or a mathematician, or if you're a futurologist in the realm of science, he would not have been able to survive, because he was living at a different level, the world of ideas, hypothetical possibilities of modern science and technology, and so on. So that's a clear proof that you can dissociate yourself, you can ascend beyond the physical, beyond even the mental. It's possible. But there are people who can be physically sick, mentally sick, and intellectually suffering from boredom. They don't find any meaning in life. But even then, one could remember, if you could remember that you are something that goes even beyond the intellect, beyond the mind, beyond the vital energy, beyond the intellectual or mental ideas, you are the Atman, which is, in its true nature, is Ananda. It's Anandamaya Kosha. That's the last, fifth one. The sheath of inner blessedness. Now, there's a great difference between happiness and blessedness or bliss. Happiness becomes real happiness when it is linked to bliss. When happiness detaches from bliss, then it is a very short-lived, a temporary absence of unhappiness. When happiness is linked to the real source of happiness, which is bliss, then that happiness is an everlasting state of spiritual growth. So the fifth sheath in Vedanta is Anandamaya Kosha. That comes closest to our true nature. So in other words, unhappiness is a foreign body. It's something alien to us. Sickness, unhappiness, misery, tragedy, despair, all these are alien. They are foreigners to our true nature. What's our true nature? What's our home? Our real home is Ananda. And what is Ananda? Ananda is defined in Vedanta scriptures and yoga scriptures also, in Tantra scriptures, as something which is beyond definition, which is beyond description, which can only be explained as experience. And experience can never be explained. Experience is something that can only be experienced. All other lower dimensions of bliss, which we call happiness, can be explained. The problem with modern psychology is modern psychology is struggling, working very hard to explain, but it doesn't go one inch deeper into the system. So Vedanta tells you that there is something in us, in all of us, which is essentially, inherently, by its very nature, non-different, non-distinct from happiness in its ultimate dimension. And what is the ultimate dimension of happiness? Is bliss. And so Anantamaya Kosha is the sheath that sits closest to our true nature, which is a reflection of Atman itself. So here, this wife, Maitreyi, is a very intelligent person, as great a philosopher as her husband, Yajnavalkya. She's asking the question, please teach me that science, which will make me happy, in the sense that I will be happy to such an extent, in such a way, that I will not feel any need to look for happiness, because I am happiness itself. My inherent nature is happiness itself, so I won't be looking for happiness outside of myself. So that's why Yajnavalkya says, Sahovaja Nava Are Patyukamaya Padipriyo Bhavadi Atmanastu Kamaya Padipriyo Bhavadi. It's a long dialogue. So I'm not going to the whole thing. What it means is, a wife loves her husband, or husband loves his wife, because by loving, by looking for happiness of others, we become happy. So the real philosophical, psychological foundation of whatever noble deeds we do for others is, by those noble deeds, ultimately, we become happy. We become blessed. So, Yajnavalkya says, once you understand this, then you know, you will realize that you have this higher dimension to your personality, which is called Ananda Maya Kosha. At the physical level, intellectual level, emotional, mental level, we cannot justify this, because you give something to others, apparently to make others happy. But from a spiritual point of view, Yajnavalkya says, we give something to others because when others are benefited, when others are happy, that happiness gives us happiness. So it is a kind of selfishness, but self, capital letter, yes, not small letter, yes. So actually it is for spiritual blessedness that we actually should look for. The real source of all happiness is spiritual blessedness. Now, this may be in the form of a dialogue, but I can give you one interesting explanation of this in the light of another very interesting dialogue. That's also from another Upanishad. It is very striking that how these ancient philosophical classics contain such deep-rooted, such intense inquiry into human nature. So I'm taking another interesting dialogue between a great teacher and his disciple. It's from the Katha Upanishad. So dialogue, there is a mythological story behind, which I'm not going into because there is not enough time. But here the dialogue is between a boy and his teacher. A little boy who was condemned to go to the Lord of Death by his own father because the boy annoyed the father when he was engaged in some important ritual. He reaches the palace where the Lord of Death was living. And he reached there, he was away. So he returned on the third day. On the third day, when the Lord of Death returns to his palace, he found a small little boy who had come in search of him, waiting for him for 3 days without food, starving. So he felt very sorry for the little boy. So he asked him, well, I'm sorry, but as a compensation, you can ask me for 3 boons. He was a divine person, so he could grant any three boons, including long life, going to heaven, all the great things. Anyway, the boy asked for three boons. That also is a graphic description of the human pursuit of perpetual happiness. That is, happiness at the physical level, and after realizing the impermanent nature of happiness at the physical level, going in search of higher happiness at another level, but then after realizing the impermanent nature of higher celestial happiness, finally looking for spiritual happiness or bliss. This is also a very interesting dialogue. So the first boon that the little boy asked for was this. Very simple. When I go back to my home, my father should be happy. He should not scold me. He had left his home, the father, without father's permission. He was afraid to go home. He may be scolded by the angry father. It was a very simple, like little boy looking, asking for chocolates. Yama immediately granted without any hesitation. So it's like happiness at a physical level. It's easy to get, to acquire. If you don't have money, you can work hard and acquire money. If you don't have a job, you can get a job. So the problem is more visible, and the solution, the remedy also is more visible. So it doesn't really shatter us. It won't rattle you when you have a problem, which is very obvious, therefore, all for everyone to see. And the remedy also is quite tangible. You can see the remedy in front of you. If there is illness, you can take medicine. If you don't have money, you can work hard and acquire money. Wonderful. So we don't have a big dilemma there. But suppose a person is very happy physically, in purely physical, worldly sense, he's very happy because plenty of money, wealth, and status. Still, he feels a kind of vacuum within, emptiness, and an invisible search for something you are not sure about it. And it causes depression. You find in countries where the state looks after everything, Medicare, education, old age home, everything is well looked after by some well-known welfare states like Japan, Sweden, Holland, a few such countries where even Bill Bismarck introduced Social Security in the later half of 19th century in Germany. So many of these countries have advanced welfare systems where the state looks after everything of the citizens. And many of these states also have the highest suicide rates, the highest percentage of patients suffering from depression, Japan, where you are looked after right from cradle to grave, but still depression, suicides, at the highest in the world. Which means they have everything, but there is something still wanting, which they feel they are not sure what it is. It's not as visible as problems and remedies are visible, obvious at the empirical level. If you don't have a job, look for a job, get a job, the problem ends. But suppose you have all these things, still there's a deep-rooted feeling of deprivation, agony, emptiness, vacuum within. If you go to a counselor, or if you go to these pep talks, you know, where executives who are not performing well have to pay $1,000 for a session, and they have to shout, I will succeed 100 times, stand up and then open your eyes and stretch out your hands and shout, I shall succeed. You may perform very well, but again depression comes in. That doesn't solve the problem. Because behind psychology, there should be a philosophy. So a psychological paradigm, a view, should be supported by a philosophy. Otherwise, it is very empty, very superficial, and very short-lived. So, I tell you one very telling sentence from Vivekananda. You know, Swami Vivekananda was traveling the United States and Europe, mostly the United States. He refers to this. And then he went to India and other countries. India was economically very backward at that time. And America, you know, Vivekananda saw a very wonderful social system, good education, and opportunity for everyone. Those who were willing to work hard and take risk, sky was the limit. A lot of enthusiasm, energy, organizational zeal, activism, innovation, all wonderful things. But then Swamiji made a statement. Swamiji says, behind this external flourish of enjoyment, happiness, there is a wailing sound, a sob. Somebody's crying, you can hear the voice. Because behind the economic prosperity, organizational genius, industrial might, industrial development, there was something lacking, which Swamiji explained, which William James, who led the great psychologist, American psychologist, later quotes in his well-known book. So he has written a well-known book, it's called, in that there is a very interesting chapter on genius and insanity, the, you know, very interesting book. And William James quotes this Vivekananda's statement. So in America, what Swamiji found was, behind this wonderful organization, prosperity, enjoyment, industrial growth, there is a wailing sound, a sob. It ends with a sob. And back to India, Vivekananda went. I'm talking about the last decade of 19th century. People living in the backward cities, Swamiji refers to Calcutta, where, or in Benares, people, poor people, maybe starving, you know, the last decade of 19th century. But there was a joy. They would say, oh, after another life, I'm doing good things now, I'm praying to God. Next life, I will be born as a rich man, happy man. So they were happy about it. So it's something very interesting. It may not be as relevant today as it was in those days. Of course, you know, times have changed. Many things have changed. What I mean to say, behind this external prosperity, there could be a vacuum. There should be an emptiness that is looking for fulfillment, which today you find in the most advanced countries of the world where social welfare system is very much advanced, but there is a kind of psychological chaos, depression, suicide rates, which shows that at a physical level, you cannot have permanent, everlasting bliss. So don't imagine that poverty is blessedness, not at all. That's not what I mean to say. What I mean to say, even in the midst of physical prosperity and wealth, there can be a deep-rooted and intense misery within. That possibility is there. That's what we are referring to. And that's what we are finding in today's Japan, Sweden, Holland, Switzerland, and these smaller countries, comparatively advanced nations. So that shows that the real happiness is somewhere else, not at physical level, not at mental level, not at intellectual level. It is somewhere else. So the little boy asked for the second boon. Well, here I'm happy, but this happiness I know it won't be there all the time. I may die after 100 years. After 100 years, when I die, what is going to happen to me? Am I going to take all the wonderful things that you have given you, that you have given me, sorry, that you have given me, wealth, status, long life, which I'm not going to take with me when I die? So what will happen to me? So I want to have the same enjoyment even after death. That's again a child looking for a chocolate that never gets dissolved in his mouth. Or in the Quranic concept of heaven, you know, where you, when you go to heaven, you get, you open your mouth, this grape juice will fall into your mouth. Then Nachiketa says, that is not also not permanent. Heaven in Vedanta is not a state of permanent experience of blessedness or happiness. It is only a temporary state of material enjoyments in Vedantic tradition, unlike what heaven means in the Abrahamic tradition or in the Christian tradition, where heaven has got a spiritual element which is not there in the Vedantic concept of heaven. It is not a very high status. So Nachiketa asked his teacher, I am not satisfied with this heaven because that's not going to make me happy all the time. So could you teach me something which will make me so happy, which will make me so blessed that I will not feel any need for any further effort for experiencing happiness. I will stop looking for happiness. That kind of experience I want. So in answer to this, Yama teaches him, the real happiness is within you. And that happiness comes to you when you identify yourself with this Atman, which by its very nature is happiness, permanent, everlasting, and imperishable, which is the same as bliss or blessedness. So once you recognize this gift that is there within you, and you identify this as yours, and once you identify yourself with your true nature, which is happiness undiluted, which is happiness imperishable, immortal, then you will stop looking for happiness outside, because you will identify your own identity with Atman, which is happiness itself. It is purest nature. So at the end of the dialogue, the little boy was very happy. So you find there is a pursuit of happiness from physical to mental to psychological or intellectual and then to spiritual for those who have the wisdom to get dissatisfied. Those who have got the spiritual maturity or intellectual maturity to get dissatisfied, to experience the total dissatisfaction with happiness available outside, they will feel compelled to knock at the door of Atman, to knock at the door of real blessedness. Then they will understand it is, they're actually knocking at their own door. They're returning to their own home. They're identifying with their own true self. That's why Yajnavalkya says, when you do something good to others, when a mother loves her child, actually that love makes her happy. Because even by loving her child, the mother feels a great inner blessedness. So that happiness is linked to blessedness, because mother is not actually doing anything for herself to enjoy this happiness. She is doing something for her child, so that she could derive the happiness. So when you get happiness by doing something good for others, that happiness makes you permanently happy. And that is called blessedness. So we shall conclude the discussion. Maybe we'll continue this topic, maybe with a different subtitle on another occasion. Thank you. Om Shanti Shanti Shantih Harih Om Tat Sat Sri Ramakrishna Arpanamastu.